Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to a new episode of Beyond the Romance. And today I am joined by my friend, Ray Liu. And today we are going to discuss his favorite K-drama. Well, one of them anyway, Tale of the Nine-Tailed. And this one is a supernatural fantasy romance action drama, as it has been described. So it's about a nine-tailed fox, otherwise known as a gumiho in Korean culture. It stars Lee Dong-wook as Young, the gumiho, and he is basically demigod, and he is the god of the mountains. And after 600 years, he's looking for his fated love, and there she is, played by Jo Bo-hwa. The character's name is Nam Ji-ha. And of course, with any K-drama, love does not come easy, which means there's struggle, strife, villains, death threats, attempted deaths, real deaths. And we're going to get into all of that in the drama. We're going to discuss our pros and cons. And we're going to just have an easy discussion about the Tale of the Nine Tails. But before that, I'm going to ask Ray to introduce himself. And then we're going to get into all the fun things about Tale of the Nine Tails. Ray?
Thank you, Carrie. Hi, guys. My name is Ray. I'm a YouTuber here, if you can even call me that. I don't even really know. But I focus on Asian skincare. And also, I'm currently an English graduate student. I'm kind of a novelist. I write novels, but none of them are published yet. So hopefully one day. I have 7 years of experience in architectural design, but I'm kind of diverging away from it for now. What got me into K-dramas? I started when I was really young. It's because of my mom and my granny. They, back in the early 2000s, I want to say, I think that was the very first Hallyu or the Korean wave. And they would watch K-dramas almost like every time there's a new K-drama back then, they would watch it. And I would just kind of watch from the sideline, not really understanding what's going on because it's adult stuff. And I was just kind of a kid, trying to, see what it's all about. But then my very first K-drama that I actually watched all by myself was back in 2015. It's called Neil's Cantabile. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that name right. It's been 6 years and I still couldn't figure it out. But it's a young rom-com, I guess, if you want to label it that way. And then I watched Hidden Identity, which also stars one of the stars in this drama, Kim Bum. I think he did a fantastic job in that drama. And I watched them all on Drama Fever, RIP Drama Fever.
Pour one out for the G.
Yes, they did a great job. I don't know what happened. Is that what happened?
They bought it out, and the people who were in charge did not see the value in K-dramas, and the platform cut it out. And now look at, lo and behold, 3.5. No wait, it's more than 3.5 years because I think Drama Fever went out in the end of 2016.
Yeah.
Oh, this is 4+ years. Where they could have been building that platform and raking in all of that dough from subscribers.
And Netflix, Vicky were so smart. They got it right.
Yeah.
They got it right. But RIP Drama Fever, they're a real one. But then because Drama Fever was gone, I didn't know any other outlets to watch K-drama. So I stopped between 2015 to 2020. Because then I didn't realize that Netflix has so many great K-dramas. And then my friend put me on Crash Landing on You. I think it's easy to say that it's everyone's favorite. And then I also watched Record of Youth. And then because of these two dramas, I was I'm kind of sucked back into this K-drama lifestyle. And then of course, we have our show of discussion today, Tale of the Nine-Tailed. So specifically, this drama, I was interested in seeing Kim Bum. Like I said, Kim Bum did a great job in Hidden Identity. And then I came for Kim Bum, but I stayed for the rest of the show. That's how good the show was.
Yeah.
I think that's pretty much it.
Yeah, this, I like a lot of people have, the one thing I love doing the podcast when I'm starting it and doing this now is I always start asking the same question, like, what got you into it? And the reason I do is because it's just so interesting to see people's pathways, not only to K-dramas and just Asian dramas in general, but just like finding things that interest them, whether it's like if you get into photography, what was it that started someone for doing photography as a hobby and then as a career? And like, kind of me, like I'm doing this like partly as a career now. And it's just interesting to the shows that people gravitate towards, because every show is not for everyone. And I think that's one of the beauties of Korean dramas, or absolutely, even like Japanese or Chinese or Taiwanese dramas or whatever, or what have you, is that there's so many genres, and in those genres, there's so many subgenres, and then there's so many different filming styles. A lot of the directors I find don't have particular styles, though, man, there are some that you can like see their like little signatures or whatever. But I just find there's so many dramas to choose from, like there's always something for everyone. And you were telling me that, as you said, you got into this drama because of Kimbum, and then you got into Nine Tails because of the others. And I remember you asked me about Irang-uk, and I'm like, yes, I love Irang-uk, he's like bae. And like for me, my first drama with him was, that I have a very vivid memory of, is Scent of a Woman. And I love that drama. It has like, it's so sad, but it's so beautiful. And it has one of my favorite like all time tango dance scenes in any like film or TV show ever. So good. But yeah, so we'll get into the Tale of the Nine Tails now. So I didn't mention it before, but the show was directed by Kang Shin-yo. And I think they did a pretty good job with this drama. It's not perfect. There are things, as I said, we're going to get into, but for what it is, I think they did a pretty good job with this drama and balancing so much genres, like it's action, fantasy, supernatural. Like it's kind of hard to balance these things in a show. And I think they did a pretty good job. So like for you, could you tell me like the things that you didn't necessarily like about the drama?
Oh, okay. It's really hard to point out any cons, because I just feel like I really want to preserve that satisfaction I had with the show, but there are a few cons nonetheless. Mm-hmm. I would say, first of all, Gia as a character, I think her agency was lost somewhere the moment she met Lee-yong, like the love of her life. Mm-hmm. I think in the beginning, we see Gia as like this powerful, very independent businesswoman. Like she is, you know, she leads her own team in a supernatural program in Korea, in a big television network. She's not afraid of ghosts or whatever. You know, she's not fazed by scary things, right? Because she's had this supernatural experience or encounter with her parents disappearing and all that. So growing up, Gia kind of built this really strong front, but then I feel like that agency, like that the independence that she had in the very beginning, Gia, was just kind of like obliterated the moment this guy came in. And I think also, because this is a supernatural and a fantasy show, of course magic is involved, and when magic is involved, the plot is so important, because you have to make sure that the magic doesn't get in the way of the plot. And what I mean by that is, there are so many moments where magic solves the issues, right? So one of the biggest problem in the show is the Imugi, which is the big villain, the big monster boss, the serpent, right? And apparently Granny, the actress's name is Kim Jung-nan, who plays Ta-Lui-pa, who is the younger sister of King Yom-na, the supreme ruler of the underworld. And she has a lot of powers. Like she can revive the dead if she wants to, if she wishes to break the rules. And it comes down to whether or not this character wants to break the rules in order to prevent Imugi from wrecking havoc on society, right? So personally, I think the granny could have prevented a lot of things from happening, but because her character is so by the books, she would not break the rules. And because of that, so many things happen. Mm-hmm. And I feel like it's necessary, but also annoying, because it's necessary that we need a character who keeps the balance of the world in terms of having magic, having no magic, life and death and all that. But because of her character, I'm just like, oh, some characters didn't have to die, you know. And there's just also in general sense, there's a few times when we would get like a very blatant explanation, you know, to us as audience. And sometimes like the more important things are left open for interpretation, like the very last scene. I'm like, what? So those are my three cons.
Yeah, for me, I have a lot of the same issues. Actually, not a lot of the same. I have the very same issues. For starting with Gia, like you, as you said, she does start out at a pretty strong character. She is a reporter. She is a producer for a show where she does like kind of like an X-Files type of reporting, and it's interesting because it starts out with her doing super like discovering like supernatural beings or covering stories that have unexplained reasons and situations. And I thought that would have been a really good way for that to carry throughout the rest of the show. I think making it a part of her connection to her family explicitly as and her relationship with Eon, I think was a mistake. I think it would have been nice if this could have been a bit more procedural, whereas like we saw her and Eon and her crew actively going after more of the supernatural beings and having like, you know what I mean? Like he did meet other supernatural beings, but usually she wasn't a part of that, those situations. I think it would have been a bit more to have her be more involved in discovering these things. And I think that's where and I think that's where the show started to fall apart, where it became too much about their relationship and the fact that I personally didn't feel any connection to their relationship. Like I wasn't invested in it at all. And maybe if I was, I would have appreciated the romantic aspect more. And if anything, I kind of really didn't care for the romance in general because I thought that once we started to learn more about Irang and Yuri and Shinju, like we started to care more about these side characters. And I just don't know what happened with Gia and it's kind of weird because I think Joboa and you don't have good chemistry, but it just didn't hold my attention. I was actually more interested in him. I was just like, girl, you're annoying me. And she kept doing things that made no sense. Like he kept making sacrifices for her and doing things to keep her safe. And she still kept making same mistakes over and over. I'm like, stop it. Common sense, please use it. You know what I mean? Because there are times where he would, there's literally a scene where he's telling her, please stop doing things that make me risk my life for you. And literally, like 2 minutes later, she's doing something else. I'm like, are you listening to nothing this man has said to you? Yeah. And then I think that's, so I think that was my biggest problem with, and then the ending. Oh my gosh, the ending. I thought the ending needed so much work. Like if you're gonna discuss episode 16, spoilers, of course, everyone. My two biggest issues for the whole show in general is Irang. I think he has such a great character arc. Like they gave him such a great redemption arc as a character because he starts out being kind of like a villain and doing bad things and like being petty and harmful to people. And then
Right,
you
very
get this
mischievous character.
exactly, and we get this explanation for why he is this way, and it's that he's being made to do this because of the deal with the Imugi. Like the Imugi's forcing him to be this way. And then you and then his relationship with Irang and with Eon, I think could have been, I think was probably the best part of the show. And the fact that it kind of gets sacrificed at the end. I kind of saw his death coming, but the way it happened kind of upset me because he deserved to get to say a proper goodbye. He deserved to get to hug his family. He deserved to get to give Yuri and the little boy a hug, and even Shinju, like they were family. Like he deserved to get to see him. And watching them running to him from afar, I thought that was just a petty. I just thought it was petty and uncalled for. He deserved a proper goodbye, and then to bring him back as a child.
I see what you mean. I totally get I get the frustration because when I first saw it, I was like, no, they didn't do him that dirty, did they? Like he's not really dead. He got sucked into that bag, right, by the underworld god. I was like, he's not dead, dead. And then when he got reincarnated into the same child, at least the same child's face, at the very last scene with where he falls off the bike, I was like, oh, what? And then, however, when I saw that the kid runs to his mom and Eon kind of just watches him run away and hold his mother's hand, I kind of understand why they did that because from the get-go, Irang the character never really wanted to embark on this journey of being a gumiho, right? He was a human, or like he was a half human, half god, I guess, because the gumiho father had an affair with the human woman, and because of that, we have Irang. And Irang is different from Iyon because Iyon he's a full-fledged nine-tailed fox. He is who he is. He owns it. He's fine with it, and he loves his lifestyle. But Irang, I think he had this identity crisis between both beings. You have the fox being, you have the human being. And I think what Irang wanted most and what he was afraid of most, and we've seen that in the show, is that his mother abandoned him. His last living human relative or a family member abandoned him because she deemed him as a monster. And I think that's all Irang ever wanted, right? That's all he ever wanted. He wanted a loving mother. And I think it does come full circle at the end because he gets reincarnated into a child again, this time fully human, and he has a mother who loves him. I think it was kind of heartwarming to see that scene. It kind of eased my frustration a little bit.
But the problem is that it doesn't make sense logically. And the reason I'll say this is because time. With reincarnation, when you're reincarnated, you are a new soul in a baby's body. Like you're born as a brand new human being. 6 months later, he's a full grown child that's like, what, 6-7 years old? That doesn't make sense. So what happened to the soul that was in that child? It couldn't have been Yang because he was a grown adult with 600 plus years of history. It made no sense. And I was like, okay, even if they do that, like he has no connection to his family. I think I would have appreciated it more if he had come back and we saw him interacting with the other little boy. I want to call him Blackie because that's what
the little puppy.
Him. Right. Like his little puppy when he was a child. And like that puppy came back as a child. He has that history. And so then I would have appreciated for him to have some connection with the family. Cause it, you know, I like that he's with a mother and he's happy now, but it just felt like he was robbed of the family that he had.
I agree with that. And that's a great point with the logic, because I don't think it's official that he had reincarnated to the child, right? I think Eon just had the flashback where he was like, you look just like my little brother when he was little. But I don't think there was ever anything
confirmation.
That said, like, right, there's no confirmation saying that this is Yang as a new child. Like you said, 6 months and you have like a 6-year-old child walking around, that's impossible.
But that's what I mean. Like the show isn't clear about anything. The show doesn't make that. I think the show should have made it clear where it's like, okay, so like, because as they've established in the even in the show itself, where just because you have the face doesn't mean that you are the same body. But what the show failed to do is because with if you use Gia as an example, Yeon thought that all the women that he met before wasn't Aram coming back because he didn't recognize the Fox B. But then it's proven in Gia that the Fox B was in her all along, but he just wasn't able to see it because the Imugi, like basically the aura of the Imugi was like blocking it. So who's to say that all of those women that he met before really wasn't Aaron come back, but he wasn't able to recognize the fast beat in her. So like the show contradicts its own mythology and it contradicts its own rules. And then using another show like Goblin as an example. So Goblin, like, have you seen Goblin?
I haven't. That's on my list because I know he's in it now. So I'm like, I'm going to have to watch
it. Yeah, he plays Reaper. So the reason I mentioned it is because Goblin does a really good job of like showing how reincarnation, especially in drama, should work. And I wonder if I should say it because it would be considered a spoiler.
Say it because I'm okay with spoilers with TV shows. Books, spoilers.
Well, and let me see. And Goblin came out in 2016. So it's like, you have like, everyone, you have 5 years of like, history. So it's like 5 years old. Second spoiler. So at the end of Goblin, what happens is the character that he's in love with, she dies and he has to wait for her to reincarnate. And what happens? He waits 20 years. And the reason he waits 20 years because he meets her as an adult. He meets her as a 20-year-old adult. So like when she died, she was born into a baby. Maybe 5 or whatever months after. When she comes back, she's a full grown adult. So that's how reincarnation should work. But in Nine-Tailed Fox, in Tale of the Nine-Tailed, that's not how it works. because you have like, it's, and we're going to assume that the child that we meet is Eon, is Irang. We're going to assume that that's because that's how the show is setting it up. And it's doing that to prove that he, with his, the sacrifice that he made at the end was worth it. And he can't, and he got this as his reward. That happened. Eon comes back as an adult and no one questions it. Right. That's not how reincarnation works. And they bought it that he's human. How did he die? Came back, reincarnated. And then they're not saying that he like resurrected or whatever. They're not saying that he was in like a stasis, like stasis and came woke up. They're saying he died, like dead. And came back in his own body with all his memories. That's not how reincarnation works either. So I'm like, so get your facts. And I think this is where the show fell, because there was a change in the show. I think around, they went on mini hiatus, I think around episode 13, 14.
Yeah.
Right. And they had wanted, and they were saying that they were making changes to the plot and production. And I don't know what happened, but like, and I understood why, because like this, when they started to do a lot of the stuff with Imugi, that's when the plot started to become too convoluted, like the whole plague and these people jumping off buildings and no one questioning that you have 300 plus people. That's the plot. That's what happens. Kill themselves. And it's not big news. And like it happened. And in like a few scenes, it's all forgotten about. I'm like, no, this is something that should be sticking around in the news.
Yeah. I mean, it's a whole massacre basically. And they handled it really poorly. I think the final, like you said, the final few episodes, it was like a whirlwind. Like so many things happened. And I feel it felt very rushed for sure. Again, back to the Irang child, reincarnated child. I don't think they actually confirmed that it is Irang. I think it was just kind of like they wanted us to see Eon looking at his little brother once again and remembering the things, like their childhood. And they thought that it was enough for us. I don't think it was enough for me. Had I done it differently, Irang would not be dead. He would live a full life, because you know, you can't, I guess you can do it, but like for in my books, if you create a really trash character in the beginning and then you give them this amazing character arc at the very end, if that character doesn't get to
reap the fruits of their labor.
Exactly. You don't get to cultivate the fruits of your labor. Then it's kind of like, what's the point? Like, why would you give us like a trash character, make us hate the character, and then make us like the character, and then kill the character off? It's like, what was the reason, you know? And another thing is, yes, when Eon reincarnated, I felt like I needed to make so many excuses as to why he reincarnated as an adult, because they literally said the word reincarnated. So I was okay, so Gia is going to be what, maybe 60 years old by the time Eon is finally an adult. They're going to have to figure things out that way. It's going to be a weird relationship, but they're going to work it out. Okay, but no, like she gets this random red umbrella out of nowhere. It's, oh, this someone left his red umbrella for you. Okay, cool. It starts raining, it starts pouring, just like the first scene of the show. And she walks and she sees him across the street and she's like, oh, you're still alive as a full adult. Which leads me to think that this goes back to my frustration with the granny character. She is so powerful. I think that because she does control the underworld, or at least her brother does, I think she finally broke character and made a deal with her brother to bring back this guy, not Irang, because I don't think she has any emotions or emotional attachments to Irang. But for him, she's always treated Eon as her own son, right? So I wouldn't put it past Granny to kind of, you know, go to her brother and say, like, hey, bro, why don't you give me back my favorite child? You can make him half demon, half human, whatever. I just want to at least see my son be happy with the girl of his dreams. That was my excuse. I was like, okay, writers, I don't care what you did. Let me just make an excuse for you so I can actually keep watching the show and not be so furious with it. Because like I said, the granny is so powerful. To a point where she could have turned Imugi into a stone, but because of course he has the moon mirror or whatever. I was like, they did that last minute, I'm pretty sure. But she's so powerful. She could do anything she wants. She could literally bring back the dead. So I think that's what happened. She made a deal so that he doesn't, Eon doesn't have to go through the whole reincarnation process. I mean, like the fact that she let him stop the granny from taking Gia to the underworld that time, back like 600 years ago, yeah. It already proves that, you know, she has a soft spot for him. She's willing to bend the rules for him, even if she's in trouble for it. So that, I guess that's my logic for the writers. They should pay.
That makes so much some logical jumps with this show. And I know everyone watching is like probably thinking, is there anything you guys like about the show? There are, but like we're just being honest. Like we're, as I said at the beginning, it's not a perfect show, and there are still plenty of things that I like, particularly the performances. But we gotta be honest, like there's things
sure.
that happened with the show that it kind of betrays the characters and the writing and the setup that we had. And that's one of the reasons of like doing this podcast is like you gotta take
we're
the
fair.
Better with
we're
the sweet.
Fair.
Exactly, we're being fair, we're being honest, and that's what, and as a film critic, that is also my job.
In fact, a lot of my favorite movies, my favorite shows, my favorite books are not perfect, because what I categorize as like something that I loved that I can remember forever is that it's the feeling that I get from watching the show, and I got that from this show. I would like randomly, like in the morning brushing my teeth, I'll be like, oh yeah, that scene was really nice, you know, like I love that kind of feeling. Like you don't have to give me like I think people can arguably say that Game of Thrones is like minus season eight and parts of season seven, but like the first six seasons, everyone's saying that it's like the best show. It's done so perfectly, whatever. Okay, I can agree to that, but then is it my all-time favorite show? It's not, because it doesn't bring me back to certain moments like randomly when I'm going about my life. So like you said, we're trying to be fair. Like it's a great show. There are, you know, bits and pieces where we think that it's a little shooketh puzzle that needs to be put back together if they were to be able to do so in the future.
Yeah, like you mentioned Game of Thrones, dude. The thing with Game of Thrones is, even though the first like six seasons were like pretty darn good, like the saving grace of that show from beginning to end was the performances and the production quality and the choreography and the music and everything else. But the story itself, crap, let's be honest. But the difference between like discussing a show like Tale of the Nine Tail and Game of Thrones is there are things we don't like. There are the good things that we do like. I would like hear like the theme occasionally in my head, like, you know, the song from her little her music box. I've been hearing that and I love that theme. I think it's like really well composed. And then like I get upset about Eden because Kim Bum did such an amazing job with that character, and his story arc is so good. I think he has one of the best redemption arcs I've seen in a K-drama. And that's why when you, so like you can do that, but then the difference between Game of Thrones now is like, now when people think about Game of Thrones, like you saw my initial reaction was a deep sigh, and like that's what they did to us for those last two seasons. Like we're just tired of the show. Like
please. When I think of Game of Thrones, I think of that water bottle, the coffee cup. I'm like they ruined it. I'm just like, what happened? Anyway, let's move on.
Well, we could go on forever about Game of Thrones, but no, we're gonna get into the pros of Tale of the Nine Tails. So Ray, what were your pros for the show?
I had to add one just now when we're talking about Lee Dong Wook. It's my first drama that I've ever seen him in, right? Mm-hmm. So I wasn't expecting much. Like I said, I came into the show for Kim Bum because I know he's a good actor. Lee Dong Wook, I've never seen anything. I've never seen him before. I've never seen the face. Mm-hmm. But then I was watching... backtrack a little bit. Another reason why I started watching this show was because my favorite Monster X member, Shonu, he sang the theme song or one of the soundtrack songs. And I love that song. It's like my all-time favorite song between 2020 and 2021. I love this so much. And I was like, okay, I'll watch a show for this song.
I think you told me that, yeah.
Yeah, episode six was when the song first appears. And mm-hmm. I paused, I jumped around my room. I'm like, yo, there's a show, this song. I was so happy. So I had watched a show for Shonu's appearance as a vocalist. But with Lee Dong Wook, I've never seen him before. I've only seen him because I watched a music video for the soundtrack. And I was like, who's this guy? Why does his, he has really big eyes, and also he like he has like I don't know how many folds of like eyelids. Like I have like I think two, but he has like three at least. Like it's almost mesmerizing to stare into his eyes. And I was okay, he's a good looking guy, so I'm sure he has a lot of fans. But because of that, like my quick little prejudice is that, or quick little assumption or judgment is that the good looking people tend to not be that great of an actor, right? But he blew me away. He is so, I wrote it down, Lee Dong-wook is funny, all caps. He is so funny. The comedic timing is always on point. I love his charisma. I think I've said this to a friend once, and I'll say it again. Like, I have never met a K-drama male lead with such charisma that isn't annoying. Like, I don't know if you know what I mean. Like, you can be very boastful, you can be very proud of yourself, and you can be so charismatic and charming, but then you can also come off as very annoying. He didn't give that to me. Like I was like, I want to be like him when I grow up. No, so Lee Dong-wook is a great actor, I think, and that's why I said I'm gonna have to go back and revisit his filmography very soon, starting with Goblin. And another pro is the, I know we talked about the logic is very all over the place, but I do think that they did a great job with the Gummiho lore, the myth of it. I think they paid really good respect to it. I also think they blended the traditional myth with and placing it in modern Korea. I think that's done really well. Because it could be very literal where they plop a 600-year-old nine-tailed fox into Seoul, Korea, and just trying to make it work. But I think they did a great job tying in, you know, the granny, Mr. What's his name? Hyun Eung, the gatekeeper of Samdo River. He's also very funny. So like bringing all these other characters, like the Grim Reapers, the gatekeepers. I believe the granny's called the Black Fox because she is able to control the opening to hell and to, or the underworld and to the land of the living. We have the nine-tailed fox, and then we have like zombies. So I think it's pretty cool. Like I think they did a pretty good job blending the landscape of the traditional Gumiho myth and also the modern life of Korea. So those are the things I really liked about the show.
Like I like same things, like starting with Lee Dong-wook. I love him. Like you other side, like he's such a great actor. But one thing I love about him is he's very good at doing serious and comedy at the same time. Like he switches very well.
Yes.
And his facial expressions, like I'll be bold and honest to say there are some actors and actresses that their faces are not very expressive. And I don't know if it's because they don't know how to emote very well, but he uses his face so brilliantly, and his face and his facial expressions are always hilarious. Like if you love his performance in this, you will love Goblin for sure, because he his character as Grim Reaper is unexpectedly funny, and he does not physical comedy, but I call it is physical comedy in like how he uses his body and like little gestures, and like he'll roll his
Yes.
eyes. And he does side eye, so he looks at people with like side eye, he'd be like, and he does it so well.
I realized I picked that up from him after watching the show. I would roll my eyes like randomly. I'm just like if some like someone I walk past like does something really stupid, I just like I would kind of like roll my eyes in the way that he does it. I'm just like, I was like, oh, wow, the Lee Dong-wook effect has taken over my body. Like that's how good his like you said like his the physiological way that he acts. It's so entertaining and so interesting to watch.
Yeah, like I use some gifs of his expressions from Goblin quite often for my tweets, and like his I just love him. And in this one, as I said, he is the one that kept me interested in the relationship with Gia, and then again with the relationship with the brother, and not only the brother, but I think with all the characters, like he has such different relationships with all of the characters, and he does such a good job matching each of these characters and the actors there themselves, because they're all really good actors, and like they all play off of each other really well, which I think is the most important thing for a male lead. Like you have to be able to
he's like the glue
and interact and have chemistry with all of the main cast, as well as the supporting actors. Like even the little boy, like when he meets him, like he's so cute and like, and has like these adult conversations with him, and it pays off and it doesn't feel forced. And then I think Kim Bum, like he's so good as Irang. Like he like made you dislike him. And then as we started to see this arc develop, like you started to sympathize with him. And there are some characters that when they have a redemption arc, some it doesn't feel earned and it doesn't feel natural. Whereas I think for Irang, the reason it feels the way it does and the reason we all connect to this character is because of Kim Bum. Like he makes you feel for him, and like the moments when he's crying and he's upset, like you, like even when he does, he's being petty and annoying with Eon, you understand why. You're understanding that he's this man that lost all the connections with his family. And even with Yuri, he says he's alone. And I'm like, no, you're not. You forgot you got Yuri back home. What are you talking about? But like it makes sense. And like Kim Bum does such a good job. And then for the show, like, even with all the problems that I do have with it, I do like how like you mentioned they mentioned different creatures from Korean folklore. Like you have Gumiho, you have Imugi, you have the Balgasari, which is like the eater of nightmares. That's the one that, like, when he sees the coins, he eats it, like he eats metal. And then you have the Urongi Gatsi, that's the snail bride. And that's a pretty popular.
I love the snail bride.
Yeah, right. And she's
I didn't know about any of that until like I was like, what's a snail bride? And I had to like read it up, and I agree, like what kept me watching the show also was because there were certain, like, once Jia and Eon Pen met, and he's like, oh yeah, I'm a fox, and what? And then she's like, okay, I'll follow you around. And mm-hmm. then they encounter all these mythical beasts and these creatures, and then that was so fun to watch. And then, like you said, like they kind of stopped doing that the more their relationship kind of flowered. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, that's kind of sad, because I love watching them in that island. And they were like, you know, the whole island would disappear, and there was like a sacrificial scene. And then I was like, that is so cool. But then what happened to it? Because they, like you said, they had focused on the Imugi storyline too much towards the end. And everything just got so complicated for no reason, actually.
Yeah, like even with the Imugi, I think what they could have done is have it integrated more with the mythological creatures, where you have some of them working for him, and that's where we could have like learned more about them. Because like one thing with like Korean dramas, like when you do have a character like Imugi, and I thought it was kind of weird too, is like they, like he didn't have any henchmen, but ultimately we found out that he, like Irang, was working for him. But I did like that we got to learn more, even though like it kind of lost its way with Imugi, but I did like that we got to learn more about Korean folklore and folktales through the character, because like we learned that Imugi is like the dragon who without legs. Mm-hmm. And so it's like different to like what would you like the typical dragon that we would imagine. And then like they kind of alluded to the fact that there are other foxes around the world, so they kind of made it global, because like Yuri, she's a Russian fox. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of like that part of the storyline, but we didn't really get much about that. Right. And I know there's supposed to be, I don't know if they're still going to do it, a special which is supposed to focus on Yuri and Irang.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping they delve into that a bit more, and that also they keep she drew around and we see their family, because I listen, if they could bring back Irang, Eon as a fully grown adult, they could, as you said, maybe the little boy isn't Irang. He's not, bring him back, and I will not complain about it. I don't care what reason they have to bring him back as a fully grown adult, and because I don't want them to like do it from his past. Like they could show like their past and how they met, but I want them as the family, that the family unit that we had. He deserves that. Yuri mm-hmm. deserves that. And that's the other part too. Like they took Yuri's family from her. He's the first person that really cared for her and that she felt connected. And they snatched that away from her. And they snatched that away from Shuji as well, from Shuju as well as the little boy. Like they took, I'm upset again about that. Like, come on.
I'm glad you brought that back up again, because I want to say there a pro is that there are so many parallelisms. And I also want to get back to Irang's the redemption arc. Mm-hmm. So the parallelism we see is Eon finds Irang in the forest, and then Irang's like a lost puppy, like he has no family anymore, he was abandoned essentially. And Eon's like, if you want to survive, you have to survive for yourself. So you either keep going or you give up. And if you give up, I'm not gonna, like, don't even look at me. So Yidang's like, okay, fine, big brother, I'll follow you. So he's following him. And then we see that happen with Yuri, right? When we get the backstory of Yuri and how Yuri came to Yidang's life, is that she was from the zoo, and then she was a fox in the zoo, and then she was being tortured and underfed and all that. And then Yidang killed the zookeeper. And then he's like, he tells Yuri the same thing that Yidang told him when he was a little boy. And then she follows him. I love that little parallelism, because it's like, it kind of speaks to the whole, like, if you do good, like, it would be passed down to the next person. So, like, it's a trickle down effect, and it's just like good vibes, right? Mm-hmm. I love that. And also with Yidang's redemption arc, like you said, redemption arcs are so hard to create, because you can create it and then it still fails at the end. In this case, it's so effective and successful. However, we just didn't like the ending. And I say it's successful because Yidang doesn't do a good deed to redeem himself. He actually redeems himself by realizing what his core issue is. And a lot of characters don't realize that. I personally think his redemption really truly stems and comes from the moment when he was put into his fear zone, or like his personal hell.
Yeah.
And Eon goes and rescues him, or attempts to rescue him. And he's like, there's your door. You have to say your biggest fear out loud, and then the door would appear. So he goes like, I'm afraid of being abandoned. My mom abandoned me, and then you abandoned me. The door opens up. And that's when I was like, he finally let it out. He finally told his truth. And I really appreciated that. And then from then on, it was like, okay, now how do we, the writers are like, how do we get people to like him now? Now that we understand why he's so, you know, tight all the time, like he's such a jerk all the time. And now it's like, well, now we know that he was abandoned, and he realizes it by speaking it out loud to his brother. I think that's something also very important, is the brotherhood, the brotherly love we don't really see a lot in K-dramas or TV shows in general, is that this brotherly bond is always unspoken of. It's always assumed that brothers have this bond, but sometimes you have to, you know, put it in your face to kind of realize that. But with Yidang's redemption arc, it was so successful because he had found the root of the issue, and then he worked on it. Because, you know, like after he was rescued and he escaped through the door, he was still lying in bed, and then there were moments where we were like, is he gonna still betray his brother, because he's technically working for the Imugi? And then it turns out he wasn't. And I love the scene where they switcheroo'd. They did the whole...
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, the Nine-Tailed Fox is known to be the trickster spirit. Even in Japanese folklore, the kitsune, they're known for being tricksters. In Chinese folklore, the hu li jing is known to be like this conniving, this manipulative spirit that kind of lures you in. So they brought that in. I was like, are they ever gonna do like the body switching? Because I've seen that in other TV shows, and I was like, are they gonna give it to us here in this Gumiho story? They did, and they did it very importantly, because Yidong and Yidang switch bodies. Mm-hmm. Both the brother foxes switch bodies in order to fool the Imugi. I love that scene too. That goes under the pros list.
Yeah, no, that's the thing. I think the fact that we all, well, it's just the two of us here, but I've seen like a lot of comments on like online, where a lot of people, they related a lot to Yidang, because he has such a great redemption arc, and as I said earlier, it's earned on his, and it feels natural. But also I think for his character, it's so important, where, especially as you mentioned, for male characters in Korean dramas in particular, where for brothers who do have a sort of acrimonious relationship at the beginning, you do see that they do start to show, they've always been showing affection to each other in little ways. Like, you know, like even when Yidang wasn't getting along with Eon, like they still would make these little sarcastic comments, and they would still make these little jokes with each other. And then once, as we said, he opened that door, and it's a metaphorical door of him, of like his emotions and facing his past, that we start to see who he really is along under the facade of like this apathetic character. And then you start to realize how hurt he's been all of these years. Imagine 600 years living with thinking that your brother wanted to kill you, right? Like that will hurt somebody. And then thinking that, and then you're like, okay, my brother tried to kill him, but then seeing that your brother like wants to meet up with him, his main concern is this woman, and like, you know, he's been searching with this woman for 600 years, you're like, okay, so what, you weren't searching for me either? And that's part of it. Like, he knows that Eon was looking for Aum's reincarnation, but he was like, so you didn't worry about me too? So like, you have to you're understanding where he's coming from. He has a lot of hurt. And then, as I said, we discover he's being forced to do all these things as well by the Imugi. And I think that is one of the best things of the show, if not the best thing for the show, is the relationship between these brothers and then how that affects everything else. Because I think once Irangs opened up to Eon and he was able to be honest with himself and his brother, it also allowed him to be a bit more open with Yuri, because even though he rescued her, he still wasn't like fully open with her and he wasn't fully trusting. And like, when she was forced to betray them to save Irangs' life, he didn't automatically believe it. He was like, no, she's doing this, there has to be a reason. And then we saw him and Shinju went to the house and he's like, we're going to rescue you. And before he opened that door, he would have never done that. I think he would have probably, but he may have rescued her, but he wouldn't have like had the trust in her, and he wouldn't have believed initially that she did it to hurt him, to rescue him, you know. But then, but after he had that revelation with he opened up himself and he was able to trust her and Shinju. And I think that's where that's the strongest writing is, the relationships, is how the show talks about reconciliation. I don't know if that was ultimately what the whole show is about, but that's what I'm looking at it as, about reconciliation.
Yeah, that's very true. I was a bit, I guess this can go under the cons list, is that when towards the end, when Yuri became like the subject to be rescued, I was kind of like, why can't Yuri be the one rescuing people? Because she's so powerful. Like, she can kick ass, right? And I almost kind of wish that Imugi had taken Irang captive and made him his like official henchman. Because at that point, the other guy, the guy with the forehead sticker, like the traitor, he was long dead, or he was like, he became like the source of the pandemic or the plague or whatever. So he was out of the picture already. So Imugi needed a new henchman, but he chose Yuri because at the time Irang was still in bed rest. I kind of wish that he had taken Irang and kind of forced him to do the dirty work, which would make us be like, no, we have to rescue him, we have to save him. And then Yuri would step up as I guess the protector of Irang and then save him. I think that would have been a really compelling story. Of course, that didn't happen. But yeah, I think I'm hoping that the spinoff or the mini series that comes with the show really is true, because I would love to see a spinoff of the Yuri gang or the Yuri family in Shinju.
Yeah, I and that's the thing, because I think Kim Young Ji, who plays Yuri, I think she does a really good job. And she kind of like is Irang, where she has this cold outward personality, but then you realize like on the inside, like she's kind of like, she's hurt and she's been through like extremely traumatic experiences. And that's where she had Shinju, and he saw her, he saw past her facade. And I think it was so great that we were getting this Bergen relationship. And one thing about his character is that he doesn't coddle her. He doesn't pity her. There's a difference between being empathetic and pitying someone. And like, she at first thinks he's pitying her. He's like, I don't pity you because you're strong and you survived this. And he's like, I just feel for you because you shouldn't have had to experience it at all. And I think like the show, and I think like the actress, like Kim Young-ji, I think she does such a good job with like Kim Bum, where you get this really good balance of like hard and soft. Mm-hmm. At the necessary times. And that's where I think it would have been great to see her rescuing Irang, because when you look at it now, out of the three main characters of the show, counting Granny, two of them eventually kept turned into like damsels in distress. And Yuri is not a damsel in distress, but you kind of also understand where that she kind of did do like an extremely strong thing, where she betrayed Yurang to save him. So understood that. Whereas I think on the other hand, if you look at Jia, she just kept making stupid decisions and kept making putting herself in situations.
Yeah.
Like, stop it. Like, you're running from ghosts and you're going to go on the roof of a building. Stay inside. Why are you running?
Jia is very frustrating to watch. I really wanted to like her because, you know, she, as a Jia as a child, she understood. She was like, oh, you're not my mom. I'm gonna stab you with the scissor. She does so. She escapes and escapes death, essentially. And then the next moment where we see her really take power into her own hands is when Yirang transforms into the schoolgirl. And it's like, oh, I need help, blah, blah, blah. Like, I was almost attacked on the bus. Someone's after me. So she was like, okay, come to my house. Here, you sit down, have some tea. And then she, somehow Jia figures it out, right? She's like, this is not the girl that I think she is. So she drops her cup or the glass. She picks up the shard and she strikes her or you know, threatens to strike her. I was like, whoa, this girl knows what she's doing. I was like, I really like this character. And once again, once Eon comes into the picture, after the scene where Eon and Yirang fights in her house and breaks all her things and trashes her place, I don't know where her character went. I don't know where Jia went. I'm like, bring her back, because ever since that moment, she's been making reckless decisions, things that don't make sense, like you said, with the ghost. Like, what are you doing in the funeral house? And then the ghosts were like, you know, choking her with a scarf and stuff. I was just like, oh, girl, what are you doing? And then from then on, it just became like, everyone needs to rescue Jia. Like, it just got to me, it felt really like American TV show. Like, one of the reasons why I left American TV shows for a while is because they kept putting this trope of the female lead needing to be rescued and saved all the time. Like, I'm fine with it if, like, you know, there's mutual saving of each other. That's great. But then when the female lead is always being saved, I'm just like, okay, I'm tired of this. Let's move on. And I think that's why we love like Shinju and Yuri, the side characters, a little bit more, because we're like, oh, they're more interesting at this point. This guy saved the show. So,
yeah, I agree. And then I just thought about it is okay, so like, even if she has this moment close to the end, I think it's in the last episode where she goes to sacrifice herself to the god of the underworld, like she's like, I'm gonna exchange my life for Eon. And I'm like, the man died for you. We went through 15 episodes of this man trying to save your life, and you're gonna sacrifice your life for him? How does that make sense? So he comes back and you're not there,
right? It was like, what's the point?
What's the point of making that mass sacrifice null and void? Which is what Yang said. I'm so glad that Yang was like,
right,
then what would have been the point for all of it? Like, she didn't even, like, yes, it seemed noble, but it's also just stupid and it makes no sense. Like, why would you do, like,
it's funny because Yang at his final moment, he became the character with the moral or a sense of moral, right? He's like common sense at the very end, like, because Yirang has always been like the guy who does the crazy things and we're just like, why? And then at the end he's like, why would you sacrifice yourself for my brother if my brother did the same for you? You guys would literally not exist in the same plane if you do that. I was like, yes, Yirang, come on, talk some sense into her. But then he also goes like, I'll sacrifice myself for my brother. It's like,
but his sacrifice makes sense because his time was also run out, because remember, like, Imugi like shortened his lifespan, so he was thinking that he was not gonna live that long, and he wasn't gonna live that long anyway, which, as I said, is why he deserved to come back as an adult. And anyway, we're not getting back into that. so we're winding down now. So, like, we've talked a lot about the pros and the cons and we've kind of given our overall thoughts, but is there any general thoughts about the show that you would like to say, anything that we haven't mentioned as yet?
I thought that the parents' storyline was kind of weird. Jia's parents, actually, because it was like, okay, for the longest time, I guess, like, the main goal of the show in the beginning was to rescue her parents, or I thought her parents had died, and then we learned that, oh, they're not dead, they're trapped in Chinese lantern plants. And then when they came back, it's like, it was anticlimactic, you know? It didn't feel like, yes, the scene where she sees them for the first time, the real parents for the first time, and they hug, and I'm like, okay, I got a little bit emotional. But then after that, it was just kind of like they became another pawn in this chess game where they can be easily killed by the Imugi. And I'm just like, oh, they brought the parents back just so they can kill them one more time. They didn't do that. But then I was just like, I kind of wish that the parents came back at the very, very last episode. I don't know if that could be possible, but something like that, where it's like, it just feel like our goal from the beginning wasn't the goal at the end anymore. And I understand it's because they wanted to really build a romance at the end. Oh, there was also a thing where these two lovebirds, it was so many back and forth. It was like, they say their final goodbye, but then they also meet up again. They say their final goodbye the second time, they meet up again. I'm just like, just pick one final goodbye and stick with it. Because you can't be pulling at my heartstrings every time you guys do this.
It's true. And I do agree with the parents. Like, they mattered so much for to her, but then when they got married, they weren't even there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, what happened to them? Like,
they weren't even there. Like, they had their own little their mountain wedding on in a field on top of a mountain. Fine, all well and good. But if you if you missed your parents for 20 plus years so much, you went through all of this ish because you wanted to find out what happened to your parents, and they weren't even there for your wedding.
You would think, like, after 20 years of trying to find your parents, you would want them at your wedding ceremony. But no, they're like, we're gonna elope. What?
Shinju, his best friend, who like for hundreds of years is not there.
Wasn't there. No best man. No bridesmaids. I mean, let's talk about
her friends. From the production company who risked their lives for her.
And they didn't have to. Okay, like maybe they did 600 years ago because they were her loyal subjects or servants or whatever. They're just co-workers at this point, and she dragged them into this mess. And then
they're not even at her wedding.
Speaking of her co-workers, I found it so strange that they gave them so much screen time towards the end. I wish they did in the beginning, because then it would make more sense. But that scene when I forgot the character's name already, but it's the female, the writer of the X-Files show. She kind of seems to be more important towards the end, because then we realize that she, Gia, and the writer's mother had like a tight bond, because Gia didn't really have a mother growing up. And then so we learned that the writer's mother, basically the auntie, came in to provide this motherly figure. So they were really tight. And it was so funny how when Imugi kind of, took possession of Gia's body in the safe house, no one's safe in the safe house. And she points a gun at the young man. That was so tricky. Why is there a gun being pulled at this man right now? And then the writer comes out of the room, just slaps her and goes like, wake up. I'm like, I would not want to slap someone with a gun in their hands. I was like, she is brave, but also it was so unrealistic at the point. I was just like, also, really, you're gonna approach someone with a gun, knowing that's a super villain. It's not just like a regular human villain. It's an Imugi with a gun, and I'm just like, oh, okay, we'll just do that. Okay, cool. Let's just forget that actually happened. I was just like, it's so weird. Like, and the fact that the writer was about to die because of the plague, that added another stake to the plot. There was a lot going on, and I agree. The Imugi thing just really took everything and everyone into like this whirlwind, and I don't think the writers really figured out the perfect way to really untangle the knot that they created. I think the show would be one of those shows where they would benefit if they had 18 episodes. Two more episodes to really flush things out, really even out and flatten out all the creases of the Imugi storyline, and then give us like a real ending, a real wedding, like not, one that is with budget and not in a cornfield.
Well, the thing is if you notice with that K-drama, is when it comes to weddings tend to be kind of small. Like, usually, like, I've seen that the whole just the bride and the groom on like in some field getting married, which is fine, well and good. Like, I don't mind it. Like, it's happened in Goblin. I think it happened recently in oh my gosh, that new one that came, that's on Netflix, something love. I want to say Downtown Love, but I know City Love.
A Love Struck.
Love Struck in the City.
In the city, yes.
Yeah, they get married on they get married in a field or whatever, and it happened in Luca at the beginning. And this happened like dozens of other dramas, and I don't mind it, but I just felt with this one, it felt unearned because those people sacrificed so much for them. The least they could have done is have them at their mountain top wedding too. Yeah. especially when the whole darn thing is centered around the romance, like the people should get to see the fruits of their labor too.
They deserve an invitation.
They deserve an invitation, God damn it.
I mean, they could decline the invitation, but at least they deserve to be sent an invitation to a wedding.
Anyway, but apart from everything you said, everyone, you know, I would always say watch a drama, form your own opinions. You mm-hmm. probably might agree with us, you probably won't, but that's the beauty of it. So like Tale of the Nine Tail, not perfect. I'm not gonna give it a score because I don't really like giving scores to shows or even like to films. I always say it's a good watch, like the performances are all worth watching. Kimba, Kim Young-ji, oh my gosh, the actor who plays Shiju,
Huang He,
like everyone is like really good, thank you. And it like the production quality is like top notch, like you know K-dramas when it comes to these kind of shows, especially Supernatural, and especially and if the characters are supposed to be rich like Eon, they don't skimp on the production quality. The sets are all beautiful, the costumes, I would wear Granny's outfit, she wore some beautiful dresses, and all those glass frames that she has. And her nails were all like, watch it. It's like really fun. You can find it on Viki. I think, is it a TVN show? Because TVN.
Yes, it's TVN.
Right, yeah.
I'm not sure if it's Studio Dragon, because Studio Dragon has been putting out really good productions. And I don't know if this is a Studio Dragon production, but it is with TVN.
It probably is, but Studio Dragon has been doing mostly Netflix shows. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if this one is Studio Dragon either, but it's TVN. So like if you're in South Korea, you can watch it through TVN, internationally through Viki. And that's it for our overall thoughts. It's worth a watch. You'll like it, and I'm sure you'll like us, be frustrated and may find some things to like maybe complain about, but that's also the beauty of K-dramas. I actually do love complaining about stuff.
who doesn't? We're such opinionated humans, right?
Are.
Especially with social media.
We are. And so just before we wrap up, Ray, are there any dramas that you're currently watching or any films that you've seen recently that you like to recommend to others?
Well, like I said, I'm gonna start Goblin probably like right after my semester's over. I just finished Strongest Delivery Man. It's a 2017 drama. It is satisfying. I liked it. I wasn't expecting much. I was just going to leave it in the background and do my other things, but then I became invested. I'm currently watching Reply 1988. It's one of those anthology series in I think it's KBS, and it's just it takes you back in time, not literally, but like the show set in an older time span. It's interesting, it's refreshing to watch because it's so different from like the more modern rom-coms or the comedies. I watched Crash Landing on You. It is a cult favorite. It ultimately brought me back to K-drama. Record of Youth, my personal favorite, it is at like the top three spot at this point, but not everyone liked it, so I understand. It's dramas are very subjective. Yeah, I think that's all. Like, I was supposed to start Love Struck in the City, but then I never got to it. I think it's because I'm just gonna jump right into Goblin because I'm excited to see my new favorite actor.
Goblin is my number one K-drama. Where can everyone find you on social media and your YouTube channel?
My social media handle is at Ray Liu R, R A Y L I U R. My YouTube channel, same name. Just search me up on YouTube. I'm not that popular, so you guys have to dig a little bit.
Don't sell yourself short.
But yeah, that's where you can find me pretty much.
Yes, and everyone, for me, you can find me on social media, Twitter and Instagram at CarrieCNH12. The information will be down below. You can find me live tweeting currently as when this episode will come out, and for the month of March, I'll be live tweet. I'm watching and live tweeting Sisyphus the Myth on Netflix. Also Vincenzo with Song Joong Ki also on Netflix.
I have to watch that too.
It's really good. It's really good. That's one I would love to talk about. And I'm also watching Word of Honor, Chinese drama, as well as Killer and Healer. So much drama. Oh my gosh. Dubai, what are you doing, dude? Like, keep it free. Anyway, but I love that. I love those ones. I've been watching The Sword and the Brocade. That one, I think it's probably, let me see, I think I'm at episode 34, 35. So I think it's going to soon finish. That one has been really good too. I recently watched Princess Wei Yang. As I said, that one should have been called Who's Trying to Frame Wei Yang, because everybody is trying to frame this woman or kill her or both. The ending, he deserved better, everyone. He deserved better.
Oh, you know what other show I have to watch? I'm probably going to watch it alongside Goblin, is Cinderella and the Four Knights, because I saw your podcast the other day, and I'm sold. I was like, I got to watch it, because I love Park So-dam. She's one of my favorite actresses. So I'm going to have to tune in for that. I know it's an older one, right? Like 2018, 2016?
I came out in 2016 too, early 2016. And let me see, what else am I watching? I'm gonna be starting, there's another C drama starting called Something at the Bat. My brain keeps saying Cricket Bat, but that's not it. It's something else. It's Something at the Bat. But you can find my live feeds using the hashtag Dramas with Carrie. You can also find my Saturday night live tweet, Saturday Night Sci-Fi, every Saturday night at 10 p.m. Eastern. And I'll be linking below links to where you can find my writing. You can find my interviews with the AFCA virtual roundtables will be linked below. I'll also provide a link for Ray's YouTube channel and his social media as well. And in the comments, you can give any shows you would like me to discuss. And again, thank you so much to Ray for joining me today.
Thank you, Carrie.
Episode of YouTube for Beyond the Romance. Yay! This was so much fun.
So happy to be here.
Yes, this was so much fun. Everyone, I'm going to try to be more consistent with my content and getting more content out. I had a little bit of a break from the first one because I was covering South by Southwest. I did like some reviews. I interviewed some of the writers and directors.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And I just needed a little bit of rest because I had covered Sundance and a whole bunch of other festivals earlier from September last year. So I needed a bit of a rest, but I will be trying to get more content out, and I'll be trying to do videos with recaps where I just give my like short recaps of like the shows that I'm currently watching. But until the next episode of Beyond the Romance, everyone, please stay safe. Bye.
Bye-bye.